This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money and your 401k and your IRA. We look at things from a lot of different perspectives here, or try to. We look at things from the perspective of economic cycles. And today we're going to look at things from a few different perspectives. Joining me momentarily is Mr. Adam Seth Levine. Mr. Levine is the author of American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And as I said, he'll be joining me momentarily. Also on today's program, I'll be looking at the economy from a few different perspectives. In the second segment of today's program, I'll be looking at U.S. housing. I'll be looking at the U.S. stock market as well as the oil market. And on the surface, when you look at those three markets, you might think that the economy's looking pretty good. Things are moving along pretty well. But is that the case? I'll look at that in depth, and I'll do so from the perspective of three former guests here on the Everything Financial Radio program. Dr. A. Gary Schilling wrote about the housing market recently. Dr. Mark Faber commented on the S&P 500 recently. And former guest and economist Harry Dent commented on the oil market and why low oil prices might actually be bad for the U.S. economy. I want to remind you that if you've not yet attended our new retirement rules class, we do have a class coming up on February the 21st. It is a 5.5-hour class. It begins at 9. It concludes at 2:30. It's on a Saturday. The cost for the class is just $49. That includes the cost of the book and all the handouts you get, as well as lunch for you and a guest. The class is held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. Again, the website to visit if you'd like more information or if you'd like to register is investingapproach.com. And we get you the book ahead of the class, as well as some reading assignments you can make the most out of your day. So check it out, newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Adam Seth Levine. Mr. Levine is the assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. He researches in the areas of economic insecurity, economic inequality, political behavior, and political communication. His most recent book is American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Adam, let's start by maybe just talking about the premise of your book. What led you to write the book?
The major premise of the book is that there's a wide variety of economic insecurities that many lower and middle income Americans are facing these days. And they include things like job insecurity, healthcare costs, retirement costs and retirement insecurity, as well as education costs. And so sort of this leads to sort of a collective experience of American insecurity that, despite sort of rises in many of these kinds of costs and insecurities, we haven't seen a lot of large-scale political pressure to stem the tide. And so what the book is sort of oriented towards is trying to understand sort of why that might be.
Well, we talk often on the program that the wealth gap in the United States is at really the widest point ever historically, and the recovery seems to have benefited the top 1%, but Main Street seems to have been left out. Would you agree with that assessment?
One of the most interesting trends that I talk about in the book has to do with exactly what's going on with people who are at sort of the middle and the lower reaches of the income distribution. And so what we're seeing is not only the kinds of trends with respect to the wealth gap and the income gap, as you mentioned, but also that the threat of losing one's place on the economic ladder is much higher now than it used to be. That is the case for a variety of reasons like the ones that I mentioned earlier.
So, Adam, why is there not more political pressure? Are the folks that are in these middle and lower income brackets or areas of the economy, if you will, are they just apathetic, or what's the reason in your view?
There's a couple of different ways of examining that question, and the two sort of major ways that I look out in the book, and what I think leads to a new way of thinking about the politics of economic insecurity, is to focus first on the question of public opinion. So that's like what you said, how much do people care about these issues, see them as important political priorities, want the government to be involved, and so on and so forth. And then the second question is the extent to which they are both being mobilized around them and then responding to those calls to action when they're received. On the public opinion question, what I observe in the book is a variety of evidence to suggest that actually quite large majorities of Americans, and this really holds across the income, across the partisan spectrum, support government action that would, say, lead to job retraining or make sure that health care is affordable or make sure that people who want to go to college can afford to go to college, things like that. And everyday sort of kinds of issues that people talk about around the kitchen table. I also find that people typically think about many of these issues as top priorities. And so, for example, when the Pew Research Center gives people a list of, 25 possible priorities for the government and asks people, should this be a top priority or not, these kinds of issues are regularly at the top of that list. And so it seems like from a public opinion point of view, there is sort of, people are mobilizable at some level. There is sort of room for mobilization. And I should also note that everything I've said so far is actually irrespective of what people might view as the ideal policy solutions. All I'm saying is that people view these issues as policy, as political priorities, and they view the government being involved in some way as being appropriate.
Well, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Adam Seth Levine. Mr. Levine is the author of American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And here we are, Adam, approaching another presidential election cycle. It's hard to believe that we're here already. What do you see happening at the national level from a political perspective to address some of these issues? To a lot of Americans, I think it just seems to be business as usual. There's a lot of frustration with government.
What we're seeing a lot right now, and this has been especially the case since the State of the Union a few weeks ago, and then certainly the budget that was proposed a few days ago, is that there's a lot of talk about economic insecurity. There's a lot of talk about middle-class angst. And that's been true to some extent for a long time, but it seems like there's more and more now, and it's certainly coming from both sides of the political aisle. What's interesting, though, is to step back for a second and think about why it is that we're not seeing a lot of pressure at the grassroots level that's really sort of pushing for the kinds of proposals that we hear people in Washington, D.C. talking about. And just to give sort of one example, and actually an example that doesn't come from the past few weeks, in August of 2013, President Obama traveled around upstate New York and touted a college affordability plan. Immediately after that plan was touted, many people in the media wrote that it's going to go nowhere and has no chance and so on and so forth. And I think it's interesting to sort of reflect upon the fact that what there wasn't in response to that plan was sort of organized political pressure that might try to push, say, Congress or some other, some other political leaders to make sure that that plan actually gets enacted. And so that's sort of like, that's a key part of sort of what I'm talking about in the book, is sort of what the barriers to political mobilization around these kinds of issues might be.
So, Adam, we've got about 2 minutes left in this segment. Let me just ask you, from purely a political perspective, if you look at what is going on on the national level, do you see that there are going to be any big changes, maybe in the makeup of with Congress now being Republican? We've got a Democratic president. Do you see more gridlock moving ahead, or do you see big changes moving ahead?
I think the answer to that question really depends upon the extent to which people in Congress believe that their constituents want them to act a certain way, and if they see that there is pressure pushing them in one way or the other, then they're likely to respond. And we have good evidence to say that when they feel like there is that kind of pressure, they do respond. To the extent that that's not the case, or to the extent that pressure pushes in opposite directions, then it's hard to imagine that we're going to see anything different than what we've been seeing over the past few years.
Well, we are chatting today with Mr. Adam Seth Levine. He is the assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. His book is American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And I'll be continuing my conversation with Adam in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us.
Come on, listen to the money talk.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will be continuing my conversation with Mr. Adam Seth Levine in the next segment. In this segment, I want to talk a bit about what's going on in the economy, and I want to give you some perspectives as to what's going on in the economy from three different markets. We're going to look at the housing market, we're going to look at the stock market, and we're going to look at the oil market. Now, when you look at all three of those markets and consider them at a glance, one would think the economy might be doing pretty well. Housing seems to be doing pretty well. Prices are up since the subprime mortgage crisis. Stocks have recently reached all-time nominal highs, so one would come to the conclusion perhaps that the economy is doing pretty well when looking at the price action in the stock market. And of course, with the price of oil now reaching lows, one would think that that's going to be good for the economy. Well, I want to offer you some perspectives on each of these markets using some articles that were published by past guests here on the Everything Financial Radio program. Dr. A. Gary Schilling has been on the program several times, one of my favorite guests to have on the program. He recently wrote about the housing market. Dr. Mark Faber, who is the publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, who's been on the program, is going to comment on what the S&P 500 may do in this next year. And, of course, past guest Harry Dent, who does a great deal in the area of demographic research, is going to comment via a recent article on the oil market. So let's start with the housing market and an article published by Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling said that U.S. housing activity remains weak despite 6 years of federal government aid, strong interest from overseas buyers, rock-bottom interest rates, and massive purchases of mortgage bonds by the Federal Reserve. For those of you that aren't familiar, when the Federal Reserve engaged in quantitative easing or money printing, they used a good deal of that newly printed money to go out and buy mortgage-backed securities. Dr. Schilling asks, after reviewing this data, does this mean that housing may never spring back to its pre-recession levels? And he says many signs point to yes. He said, first of all, you shouldn't blame the Chinese. They're showing an abundance of interest in the U.S. housing market. Their share of foreign purchases of U.S. real estate leapt to 16% in the year ending March of 2014. That's up from 5% 7 years earlier in 2007. These Chinese buyers of U.S. real estate paid a median price of $523,000, higher than any other nationality, and more than double the $199,000 median price of all houses sold. The value of home sales to all foreigners last year rose 35% up to $92 billion. Many foreigners view U.S. homes as safe investments and U.S. schools as good places to teach their children English. But even though foreign buying of real estate in the United States is robust, activity is now weakening. Why? Well, first of all, banks have had to tighten mortgage lending standards after the Dodd-Frank reform law. And that law and those regulations that followed that law are depriving these banks of revenue from some of their former activities, proprietary trading, derivative origination, and investing in off-balance sheet activities. And, of course, the mortgage refinancing surge has now also come to an end. Fed Chair Janet Yellen, Dr. Schilling writes, worries about the negative effects of tight credit standards on housing. While she admits that lenders should have raised their standards earlier, any borrower without a positive credit rating finds it awfully hard to get a mortgage, she said. Even Ben Bernanke, her predecessor at the Federal Reserve, was turned down when he tried to refinance his mortgage. So the federal government now is trying to pick up the housing market. The Obama administration is reversing some of this post-crisis tightening of lending standards. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which remain under government control and now guarantee about 90% of all new mortgages, have reduced underwriting standards on packages of mortgage they guarantee, and they now allow loans with as little as 3% down. And we talked about that a few weeks ago here on the Everything Financial Radio program. Residential construction, weak. accounts for about 3% of gross domestic product or economic output. That's down from 6% in 2005. And while the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates at the beginning of a recession and housing typically responds and takes off, that hasn't happened this time. Housing is still relatively weak. Prices of housing still 18.5% below their peak. Now, when you look at the S&P 500, looking at the stock market, Dr. Mark Faber was speaking in France recently. This article was published on January 15, 2005. And I'll give you just a bit from the article. This year could be the year when investors lose confidence in central banks' ability to engineer a sustained economic recovery, Dr. Mark Faber said. Quantitative easing, or money printing, by major central banks has pushed up asset prices, but it has not contributed to the advance of the real economy, Dr. Faber said. One of the problems of this liquidity injection, or money printing, according to Dr. Faber, is the Fed can force relatively responsible central banks to print money. Indeed, that's what's happening in Europe. Faber said that quantitative easing has grossly inflated asset prices, and as a result, U.S. equities are highly expensive. A sustainable recovery should be based on investment rather than on consumption, but companies will find it more difficult to boost profits in the current economic climate, he said. So Dr. Mark Faber says a little more upside here, but then he sees a collapse. Harry Dent commented on oil prices. This was published on December the 15th, so about 6 or 7 weeks ago. Dent said oil prices falling in a good economy like we had in the 80s and 90s, where we have falling inflation and booming productivity and good demographic trends, that's a good thing. It's a good thing for consumers and businesses, but it's a bad thing for financial markets and our whole debt structure. We have the greatest debt bubble in history. It's the greatest asset bubble in history, including stocks, commodities, real estate, and everything. So Dent thinks all prices are in a bubble, and I would happen to agree with him. Dent said the last time the bubble burst was in 2008 because of the subprime crisis. A small amount of loans went bad, and it triggered a whole debt crisis. That's what I see. Now, Dent says he sees a fracking bubble here. He said what's happened is that because of demographic trends, trends in developed countries are set to slow. Aging baby boomers spend less. He said that's very simple to see. In addition to that, you get this fracking revolution with all the low-cost money from the Fed stimulus and zero interest rates. And what you have now is we created 2 million extra barrels of oil a day just out of Texas and North Dakota. Now, the only way to counter this is if OPEC and Saudi Arabia said we're going to cut production. Saudi Arabia did not say that. We're not going to cut production because we don't like those frackers. They're competing with us long-term, Dent said, and they see this as an opportunity to squeeze out their competition. The more the price of oil falls, the more of these frackers in other marginal countries like Venezuela will go out of business because they simply can't compete with oil prices that low. It's a good long-term move for the Saudis, said Dent, but I think they're miscalculating and it could help trigger the next global crisis. We have more debt now than we had in 2008, and the demographics only get worse in more and more country. So I think this is the trigger for the next global crisis. There's $500 billion in leveraged loans with the fracking industry. Dent says, I think this whole thing is going to blow up. Who's to blame for the shaky economy we're in? Dent says, look no further than the government. What's happened is the government has created a bubble with all this short-term interest rates and all this stimulus, and their only defense is to keep the bubble going. We've got the greatest bubble in modern history by far, according to Dent. We have the greatest asset bubble across the world in real estate, commodity, stocks. Everything is in a bubble, and when these bubbles burst, the whole system comes down. We talk about some of Mr. Dent's research in our class, New Retirement Rules. If you've not yet attended, I'd invite you to check out all the information that we offer in this class. We've got a class coming up on February the 21st. That's a Saturday. That will be at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. The cost of the class for you and a guest is just $49. That covers the cost of the book, all the handouts that you'll get, and lunch, again, for you and a guest. Check it out or register at newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. We are here every week at this time, and I'm enjoying a conversation today with first-time guest on the program, Mr. Adam Seth Levine. Adam is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. He researches in the areas of economic insecurity, economic inequality, political behavior, and political communication. His book is American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And Adam, let's just jump back in. You talk about the concept of political mobilization, and you mentioned that that phrase or those two words, if you will, in our first segment. Define political mobilization for our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with that term.
Sure. So in the first segment, I talked about why there's sort of, in theory, I think people are mobilizable around these issues because they want the government to be involved and they have an idea that they should be political priorities. And so the next question then arises, okay, during potential policy debates and things like that and response to policy proposals, should we expect to see people be mobilized? And what I mean by that is, should we expect to see them, let's say, donating money to organizations that are advocating on those issues and or potentially spending time either volunteering with those organizations, attending meetings, contacting their representatives, gaining more information, talking to their friends, and things like that. And so largely what I'm focused on here is essentially the expenditure of time and or money on issue advocacy, which, and issue advocacy has a very long tradition in the United States.
Are the middle class and the lower income classes, Adam, at a bit of a disadvantage when it comes to mobilizing, because mobilizing requires either money or time, and given that the wealth gap is widening, the lower and middle classes seem to have probably less of each.
One of the interesting things that I find in the book is that a lot of the people who are facing economic insecurity and might be concerned about economic insecurity are not necessarily, they're certainly not objectively poor. Some people certainly are, but many people are not. And so in theory, they have money that if they wanted to or in principle could be spent on, and time that could be spent on politics. And so one of the questions that I'm especially focused on is the conditions under which they might be willing to do that. And so what I focus on, especially in the book, is this idea of is the rhetoric that gets used when you actually try to mobilize people around these kinds of economic insecurity issues. And I think the key, the crux, really, is that mobilizing people around these issues entails reminding them about financial constraints that they either presently are facing or potentially could be facing in the near future. And so the effect of that is to both reduce their willingness to spend money on politics, as well as potentially their, as well as in many cases, their likelihood of spending time on politics, especially if they're in the labor force. And so the name that I give to that in the book is self-undermining rhetoric. So rhetoric that brings to mind considerations that actually undermines the very purpose that rhetoric is trying to achieve. And so I think that rhetoric about economic insecurity issues that is trying to get people to spend time and or money on issue advocacy is precisely self-undermining in this way.
Can you give us some specific examples of some of this self-undermining rhetoric, as you say?
Sure. Some of the best examples we've seen from recent years would be, for example, trying to mobilize people during the healthcare reform debate in 2009 and 2010. There was an organization called Healthcare for America Now, which is a progressive coalition that was both largely pushing for what ultimately became the Affordable Care Act, as well as actually the public insurance option, which ultimately was not part of the Affordable Care Act. And so a lot of their mobilization was about, you know, the key sort of, you know, issue as they saw it at the time, you know, the idea that we have this huge rise in the number of people who don't have insurance and can't pay for health care. And so that kind of rhetoric about how people are having a really hard time paying for health care, they might not have insurance, costs are skyrocketing, the threat of personal bankruptcy due to health-related reasons might be really high. All of that kind of rhetoric is potentially self-undermining. And what's interesting, and what I talk about in the book, is that when I interviewed people who were involved with Healthcare for America Now, which I should point out was very successful in a lot of ways in ensuring that the Affordable Care Act ultimately did get passed into law, particularly after the Democrats lost their supermajority in the Senate, despite all that, when I asked them who actually was involved with, who are their members essentially, you know, who was mostly involved with their efforts, what I learned was that it was mostly middle to upper middle class professionals who likely had very good health insurance. And so, in other words, the people who were involved with the main organization that was pushing for the Affordable Care Act or, you know, health care reform more generally was largely composed of a membership that arguably needed it approximately the least.
Very interesting. We're chatting today with Adam Seth Levine, the author of American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And Adam, just based on the book and your research, we're really talking about mobilization and advocacy. Do you see that being an advocate for economic inequality, do you see that as a growing trend? Do you see more participation moving ahead? And if so, why?
One of the things that I think is really kind of interesting to come out of the book is to say that there's this extra barrier to mobilization around these insecurity issues because they remind people about these financial constraints that doesn't arise with other kinds of issues that don't remind people of financial constraints. And so what I try to do is to say I think it's very difficult to ask people to spend money and if they're in the labor force to spend time after you've reminded them about financial constraints. And so to the extent that you have a set of people that really care about the issues but aren't necessarily personally affected by them, they care about them for some other reason, those are the people who are sort of most mobilizable. On the one hand, that's potentially very promising. On the other hand, the one thing we have to watch out for in a situation like that is what kinds of policies they might actually, when they're doing that kind of advocacy, what kinds of policies might they support relative to the people who are maybe less likely to be involved. The other thing I should also point out is the sort of main exception to arguably the kind of, you know, lack or not lack might be too strong of a word, the sort of, you know, not overwhelming amount of political pressure on economic insecurity issues has been senior citizens on retirement insecurity issues. Certainly the AARP, as well as many other organizations, have been extremely successful in recent years in pushing for or preventing reforms to Social Security and Medicare. And what's interesting about that phenomenon is that the self-undermining rhetoric that I'm talking about, these reminders about financial constraints, if people are in the labor force, they're less likely to also spend time. If they're not in the labor force, like, for example, many members of AARP, they actually can very easily be mobilized to spend time. And so the theoretical structure that's in the book sort of maps very nicely onto sort of why it might be really difficult to mobilize people, for example, who are facing really high health care costs, but yet less so working-age people facing very high health care costs, but less so, for example, retired people who might be very concerned about Social Security and Medicare.
So, Adam, moving ahead, when you take a look at this widening wealth gap that we talked about in the first segment and take a look at the fact that, you know, middle America is really not participating in this economic recovery, do you see moving ahead that the economy is going to be improving for these folks, or do you think this will be a continued struggle?
We have some evidence so far that the economy is starting to improve a bit, certainly relative to for those folks, certainly relative to the way the situation was a few years ago. For example, the Commonwealth Fund runs a survey every couple of years in which they ask people, a random sample of Americans, they say, have you had any sorts of particularly negative experiences with obtaining health care or paying for health care over the past 12 months? And so the proportion of Americans that have responded to that survey, in 2014, and said, yes, I have had to delay care over the past 12 months, or I have had difficulty paying for care that I've received over the past 12 months, did go down relative to the previous survey in 2012. But to give you an idea of the numbers, in 2014, that was about 35 to 36% of working age Americans. And a couple of years before that, it was a few percentage points higher. So that has gone down. At the same time, that's still 35 to 36% of working age Americans who are still having trouble paying for health care in 2014. And so I think, you know, there's definitely a glass half full, glass half empty situation going on here. But I think that the amount of economic insecurity that people are experiencing now is still tremendously high.
You know, you mentioned, gave an example of a group that was very successful, AARP, in mobilizing folks to prevent reforms to the Medicare and Social Security programs. when you look at the reality of the finances of all entitlements, but let's just focus in particular on Social Security and Medicare, how much longer can this group continue to be successful?
A lot of that really comes down to political pressure. It's by no means just politics and political pressure, but that's really a large part of it. And I think that really, you know, what your question is really getting at is why it's so important to study issue advocacy, and why when we see proposals, like, for example, in the first segment I mentioned, the college affordability tour that President Obama went on in August of 2013, when we see proposals like that and tours like that occur, to sort of step back and think not only what might Republicans and Democrats in Congress do or not do, but think about the degree to which we are seeing or not seeing issue advocacy from ordinary citizens who are organized, pushing for certain kinds of reforms or not, and really sort of like focus on whether, you know, the presence or absence of that. And I see that missing from a lot of conversations. And so I hope with the book not only to sort of point that out, but then also to sort of give people a new way of thinking about when people are willing to engage in that kind of advocacy. And that new way of thinking is extremely communicative in nature, because it really fundamentally is about what gets communicated when organizers and elites talk about economic insecurity.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Adam Seth Levine. He is the author of American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. And Adam, if somebody wants to pick up the book, where would they find it?
It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, as well as many other smaller bookstores around the country.
Terrific. Well, thank you for being with us. We hope you'll come back. I enjoyed the conversation very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis. I enjoyed it as well.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm Dennis Tubergen, your host. Glad you tuned in today, and I want to take a little time this segment to talk about what's going on in the world economy. I spent some time on that in the second segment of today's program, looking at not only the oil market and stocks and housing, but in this segment, I want to look more at what's going on in the world economy from a currency perspective, because understanding what's going on between currencies can give you a really good, clear picture as to what's going on in the world economy. And I want to start by talking about a decision that the European Central Bank recently made. And if you're not familiar with the European Central Bank, the European Central Bank is simply Europe's equivalent of the Federal Reserve. It's their central bank. Now, when you have a sluggish economy, like really we have in most every country around the world today, with just a few exceptions, but certainly in Europe, what you decide to do if you're a central bank is first lower interest rates. Reducing interest rates has typically the effect of spurring economic activity. However, when you reduce interest rates and you still don't get the desired economic growth, you still don't get the growth you're looking for, you then resort, at least of late, to something called quantitative easing, or QE. Now, there are other terms by which quantitative easing or money printing is known, and the Financial Times article I'm going to share with you uses the term bond buying program. Well, essentially, when you hear that, all it means is that the central bank is printing money literally out of thin air to buy an asset. And now let me give you just a bit from that Financial Times article. The European Central Bank launched its long-awaited bid to revitalize the Eurozone economy and counter deflation with a 60 billion euro a month bond buying program that was far larger than investors had expected. European Central Bank President Mario Draghi said the bank would buy more than 1 trillion euros in assets, including government and private sector bonds, by September of next year, and even held open the option that the program might be expanded or extended. And of course, the goal of the European Central Bank is to get inflation to around 2%. That's the goal of just about every central bank. As we'll talk about in a moment, they're just not getting there. Now, this decision to print money was opposed by Germany. Obviously, Germany's got a fairly strong economy relative to the other economies in Europe. And German business leaders and political leaders said, we don't want this money printing because it's just going to mean other European countries can kick the can down the road and not bring their own spending under control. Now, investors, according to the Financial Times article, welcomed the move, as they would. Bond prices rallied across Europe, which is obviously an artificial rally if you're printing money to buy bonds. Of course, bonds are going to rally, but it's an artificial rally. And stocks in Europe rose significantly. The euro weakened significantly. Well, easy money is crack for the markets. Easy money, stock markets love easy money. Now, Mr. Draghi, again, Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank president, said, expectations work only if there is a certain credibility. Today we're showing that credibility is deserved. I love how central bankers talk about the fact that printing money adds to their credibility. Certainly that is spin. After strong pressure from Germany, it was agreed that national central banks would assume most of the responsibility for losses from any default or restructuring their national debt, breaking with the Eurozone tradition set by previous sovereign bond buying schemes. There will be, however, risk sharing on 20% of the assets, which is largely debt issued by European institutions bought by national central banks. The likelihood of European quantitative easing or European money printing had become much greater after it emerged in December. The Eurozone had fallen into deflation for the first time in more than 5 years. Well, deflation, technically defined, is a contraction of the money supply. Why does the money supply contract? Well, for a couple reasons. One, money quits moving. When money quits moving from one bank to another, economists would say the velocity of money is slowing, less money is created. On the other hand, when money moves more quickly, more money is created. The second reason that we have deflation is that there's more debt that can possibly be paid. And since 95% of all money is debt, when debt can't be paid, money simply disappears from the financial system, and that's what's happening as well. And that affected Europe. Europe was definitely in deflation, so now the European Central Bank is attempting to add money to the system through money printing faster than money leaves the system through defaults and through lack of velocity. Now, the European Central Bank talking about, again, printing 1 trillion euros between now and September of 2016. And as a result, the euro hit its weakest level in more than 11 years, dropping nearly 2% against the dollar. Stock markets rose, which, again, happens whenever there's money printed, because all you're doing is changing the metric. If you think about it, if you look at the dollar index, the U.S. dollar index, the U.S. dollar index has lost about one-third of its purchasing power since 2000. Well, if you take a look at what stocks have done and adjust for that one-third less purchasing power in the dollar, what you really have is a flat stock market. So you're changing the metric. It seems like the market is higher, but when measured in real terms, it's not. There's an article about Europe's quantitative easing program in The Guardian, which is a UK publication. It's written by Simon Jenkins, and he titles the article, QE for the Eurozone is a gigantic confidence trick. It should fool no one. I'll give you just a bit from that article. At last, the Euro's lords and masters have accepted that something must be done about their zone's lamentable growth. They will unleash a massive bond buying program, translation, money printing program, totaling a reported 1 trillion euros. The former BBC economic pundit Stephanie Flanders told the world it was Santa Claus time. The European Central Bank has ridden to the rescue. Jenkins says, no, it's not. Europe's great and good are partying. They're blinded by snow and celebrities. Santa Claus gives presents to the people. The European Central Bank gives presents to its banks. It's merely tipping large sums of money into the vaults of precisely the institutions whose crazy lending caused the crash of 2008, and which have been failing Europe's economy ever since. There's absolutely no requirement on these banks to release this money into private or commercial bank accounts. Given the fear of overlending that regulators have struck into bank bosses since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the money will simply build up as reserves. That's exactly what has happened to quantitative easing in Britain since 2010. There's been no surge in bank lending. And that's exactly what's happened here in the United States. Jenkins says quantitative easing is a gigantic confidence trick. It was promised that it would yield new investment. It has not. It was promised that it would pump money into the economy. It has not. It was also feared that printing money would lead to hyperinflation. It is not, for the simple reason that no one gets to spend the money. It's a bookkeeping transaction between a central bank and a commercial bank. It means nothing as long as banks are told to build up their reserves. Money in circulation is what matters. The whole of Europe, including Britain, is chronically short of demand, which is why deflation is such a menace. If no one can afford to buy anything, no one will sell anything or invest money in making anything. So big picture, what's going on? Now that Europe has decided to print money, what does that mean will happen? Well, I think what you're seeing going on is a race to the bottom all around the world. There was an article published in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the fact that not only is the European Central Bank printing money, the Federal Reserve has printed money, the Bank of England has printed money, the Bank of Japan has printed money, and even China now has started to ease. So you're seeing this race to the bottom all around the world. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean for you? Well, Dr. Mark Faber, a former guest here on the program, says that as a result, gold will rally 30% in 2015. Faber says, I'm positive that gold will go up substantially in 2015, say 30%. My belief is that the big surprise this year is that investor confidence in central banks collapses. You know, you can't print money forever without folks starting to lose confidence in the money printing. How long can you print money? You can't print it forever. At a certain point, people lose confidence, and that's what Faber is talking about. And when that happens, I can't short central banks, although I'd really like to, and the only way to short them is to go long gold, silver, or platinum. Faber says we have highly inflated asset markets, real estate is high, stocks are high, bonds are high, art prices are high, and interest rates and short-term deposits are basically zero. The only sector I can think is inexpensive is precious metals. And Dr. Doom, or as Dr. Faber is known, says that U.S. stocks are particularly overvalued. That's our show for this week. Before I go, I want to remind you we have a class coming up on February 21. That's the new retirement rules class, if you're not familiar with it. We talk over a 5.5-hour time frame and take a break for lunch about what's going on the economy and how it might affect you. You can get more information by simply visiting the website, investingapproach.com. You can also register there while capacity remains. That's it for this week. Bye.